Today we hear from two writers of fiction. And what is fiction but an amalgam of who we are, where we have been, and possibly where we are going, and definitely what we eat. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. Nancy Economy brings us a novel of immigration and family, with lots of good food in her first novel, The Classic Grill, a tale of Greek gods and immigrant heroes. And we'll talk with Nancy a little later in the show. Jessica Barksdale Inclán brings us a literary fantasy of time travel and Shakespeare in the plays The Thing. Inclán is an award-winning author, longtime professor of English. She has two volumes of poetry, including the recently released Grim Honey. And the plays The Thing is her 15th novel. What I've always appreciated about Jessica's work is that thematically, each novel covers different territory. Her work is filled with the humor of living, and she has an easy style. But mostly, she really makes us care about the characters. Let's listen to our conversation. Jessica Barksdale Inclán, I am happy to talk to you today about your latest book, The Plays, The Thing. It's been several years since we've talked. And before we get into this literary fantasy, which you've just created, bring us up to speed on your writing life. I think you're no longer a full-time professor, and you've come out with several other books and a couple of books of poetry, including your most recent, Grim Honey. So get us up to speed a little bit on where you're at and what you're doing.
Well, thank you so much for asking. And I did just retire. I was teaching for Diablo Valley College for 31 years, and they gave me the opportunity to work remotely for a year and then retire. And then we had COVID, which made everyone work remotely. So I stayed on for an extra semester and then retired in December. So that has been interesting. I'm still teaching for UCLA Extension and Southern New Hampshire University. So, you know, it's been a really interesting writing time because I have been disengaged from sort of the big publishing system for a few years. And really, I've gone back to the writing that I've loved doing, which is the poetry. And somehow it has been just miraculous that I've gotten these two collections out, and I've got a third together. And meanwhile, this sort of wonderful story, for at least for me, of imagining going back to meet Shakespeare has been percolating as I've been doing other things. And it was just great that I was able to finish it.
Well, what I noticed about some of your poetry, that I want to say it has the same quality or a similar quality of your other work, your novels. Your poems, they're stories. Yeah. They're little stories. They have a narrative line and perceptible characters. And I wonder, what is the difference for you in the process of writing and honing these different forms?
You know, they are narrative. They are narrative. I don't write language poetry. I always feel not quite the genius that I should feel as a poet. I always think poets are geniuses. But I like to tell little stories or discrete moments or discrete feelings or work up something that has a through line in it, at least for me. And I find that poems are so satisfying to write because I can actually see them on one or two computer screens or pages, and they're whole. And the revision process, which is very similar, you know, writing, sending it out to my readers, getting together, commenting, revising, but it's sort of, you know, I've always really liked vacuuming because you can see your progress and you can finish something. And for me, poetry is like that. It's like I can open it and close it, whereas a novel, it goes on and I can forget what's happening in a novel when I'm writing it. Oh yeah, I forgot that thread or that. And then the revision process is more like archaeology, whereas poetry is so present, if that makes any sense.
And having that kind of narrative structure, as you say, it's satisfying to see your work on the page and be able to have a beginning and an end to it. That's satisfying for a reader as well to be drawn
Oh,
in that way.
good.
Yeah. Well, William Shakespeare also wrote poetry.
Yes.
So let's talk about the plays, the thing. I'm calling it a literary fantasy.
I like that. I want
Yeah.
that to be a subgenre. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think so. It involves time travel,
Yeah.
and you don't talk a lot about quantum physics, though you give it a little lip service, but it's really about love and romance, and there's intrigue and history and literature. And there's Jessica.
Yes, there she is.
Your name's Jessica, and Jessica, I guess, is a name that came out of Shakespeare's time.
Yeah.
But it is ironic that, or not ironic, that your name is Jessica, and was that kind of an inception point for you at all?
Absolutely. And I think it's been irritating people. I probably should have put this at the end of the book, but this came out of a discussion I had with my older son's then girlfriend. And, we'd had a couple of drinks on a Christmas Eve and we sat around and she started talking about names. And I said, and she asked about Jessica. And I said, well, there's a couple of thoughts about it. And, but, Shakespeare is given credit. And Jessica, the character, appeared in The Merchant of Venice. And then she just went off on this whole idea of what if all the Jessicas in all the world haunted Shakespeare? And I was like, well, why would they do that? And then the conversation ended, but I couldn't stop thinking about that. And along those lines, my husband and I had been to this just sort of horrifying production of The Merchant of Venice at I won't name the company, but because it's a problematic play, it has some issues. And people usually try to dress up The Merchant of Venice so you don't notice the problems. And it just started to percolate in my mind. And it I didn't I've always liked my name. It's been a great name, but it's not like I'm trying to extol the virtues of the name. It's just the idea that Shakespeare, who created so many words and so many names, and it just all came together like that. But yeah, that's how it started.
And The Merchant of Venice is also plays into the plot of the book. So
Yeah.
why don't you set up the story for us, just for our listeners?
So, I've been very interested in writing about people just at the cusp, turning into adulthood. So my Jessica in the story, she's worked really hard and had kind of a hard go with relationships with her mother and a love relationship that was just wrong. And she's teaching, she's a PhD, Shakespeare expert, teaching at a very ordinary university in the Central California Valley. So things are not looking up for her, and she knows she's exhausted and depressed, but she keeps trying to find her way into her life. And so she volunteers to help out the drama department put on a version of The Merchant of Venice. And her partner in this is probably the only eligible bachelor on campus, and she's kind of ex this is like the best thing that's happened to her. She's sitting with this smart educated, nice man, helping out at a production of a play. And she has what could either be some delusional situation occur to her, or she does a brief time travel. She walks out of the theater and she ends up in another theater. And this is within the first chapter. And she suddenly, and she just, she's so confused, and everything is the same, but everything's different. And she shows up at a performance of The Merchant of Venice. And, you know, she decides that she's just exhausted. And she ends up back in the right time zone and goes home and says, I've got to change my life. I've got to make it better. I have got to just do some things to get out of this funk. And then poof, she's going to be gone into 1598. And meet right away William Shakespeare, and then we go.
and I have to say that yes, within the first five pages of the book, we get a pretty good idea of Jessica and her frame of mind, and then she's pushed into this other time. And the book moves at a good clip, and there's always something happening. And I was really kind of struck by the fantastic element of the time travel, William Shakespeare's reaction to her, and sometimes her own silliness about it all. But also that there is a real emotion of these characters. And so when you have all that going on in what we just called a fantasy, that's pretty compelling to have this lightness and fun in this other time, but also her arresting emotions all in the same story. And you mentioned, you know, she had some problematic things go on in her life. And while she's in 1598, she has pause to reflect at times about these episodes in her life. So Jessica, you must have a lot of fun with that, but it seems to require a bit of balancing in the narrative and in the pacing of the story to have all these different elements kind of moving around in the story. So can you talk a little bit about when you're bringing in kind of the real human emotions in a fantastic setting?
Well, that's a great question, or sort of commentary on the way the story moved. And I think that in a way their meeting sort of mirrors how, when we meet somebody, you know, we're on the surface, and then eventually, if we continue a relationship with the person, we deepen. And so she shows up, and for one, why I think William Shakespeare just sort of goes along with this mess is because he's been having his own delusional moments every night. A Jessica or five have been appearing in his bedchamber. So my older son's girlfriend's thought has happened in this novel, and he's just beside himself. So this person who's here, fine. Okay. He's going to go to bed and she's going to disappear. She thinks she's having some kind of dream. So she's acting ridiculous because she's like, I'm just going to wake up and this is going to be over. And so that was a moment I felt that they could really, you know, be rude to each other or tease each other or get drunk, or, and it could be lighter because both of them know that this is going to end immediately. Like it's going to go away. And I some of the most fun I had with this story was the conversation between them during this time, you know, where she's talking about her time before she's decides she can't ruin the timeline. She doesn't care anymore. And she's just going to talk. And he's just asking questions and getting answers. And And she gets to also show off a little because she's in front of Shakespeare and she can talk about his life and she knows more about him than he does. and so that presented a lot of opportunities. But then as she stays, she's got to figure out how to live and the story has to by necessity go deeper, and she realizes she doesn't know as much about Shakespeare as she thought she did. So all of her assumptions about him sort of have to turn. He has to turn toward her and realize that she is a person that's not going to disappear. And they have to find a way of living in the quote unquote real world together. And then things could get deeper. Then I could explore deeper feelings, deeper thoughts, cultural things that are going on at the time, beliefs that are going on at the time. When I began to write this novel, I had no idea. I don't know what I would have done if I had, that we would also be facing a plague. In 1598, that was ha happened to not be a plague year, but plague years were peppered throughout Shakespeare's life. So some of those issues came up as well. And it just was really fun to put them together as two people in a relationship, regardless of time.
I don't want to give too much away, but part of the story hinges on a mystery of who the sonnets were written for, and W.H. and the Dark Lady, and William Herbert, being Lord Pembroke, is a likely candidate. And so you explore that. And then you also bring up another literary character, Lady Mary Roth, who at the time was Lady Mary Sidney, who was also a writer. So bringing in these real elements, can you talk a little bit about that, about Lord Pembroke and bringing in the Lady Mary character as well? And even when, she's, when Jessica's confronting William Shakespeare, about some of the things in The Merchant of Venice. These are contemporary issues that are with us today about women and about gender and race and religion and all that. And so you have this kind of modern sensibility, but using the real fabric of that time.
Lord Pembroke, it's really unclear still who Shakespeare was writing to, but he's my choice. If we're gonna pick from who the male figure that William Shakespeare was writing to, who these love poems, these love sonnets, he's my guess. There are so many different theories, as well as the mystery of who is Shakespeare. Shakespeare didn't leave enough records for us, and that was one of the riffs in the story where she's like, "Hey, you got to sign your damn plays because we need to know who you are." But who did Shakespeare love? And there have been movies about this love triangle between. Was it Lady Mary Sidney? The time doesn't work for me. So I just kind of went on some of the existing theories about who the Dark Lady could have been, who is this man that Shakespeare is writing to, and tried to solve it for my purposes and use it in my story. But there was a lot of, the aristocracy would support artists, and there weren't any grants for writers, or in those days you had to have patronage. So it made sense that there was some kind of arrangement between William Shakespeare and Lord Pembroke, and maybe that developed into something else, or it's just we don't know. We don't know a lot about Shakespeare and his life. But Lady Mary Sidney Roth or Rothney Sidney was kind of the surprise element for me as I was writing because I thought that she opened up an opportunity for my Jessica in the story to really honor and respect teaching. And,
Yes.
it seemed at the beginning of the story, she's exhausted by her students and she's tired, and she's tired of teaching and thinking with them and not respecting them in a way because she's so exhausted. And, being able to tutor Mary Sidney or help Mary Sidney sort of presents a great opportunity to rekindle her love of moving a student through the writing process. And so I enjoyed that. The other thing was that it sort of showed how women of that time, is even in the aristocracy, are trapped, were trapped by the constraints of their society. And I gave Mary Sidney in my book a much happier end than she had in real life. And that's the beauty of writing time travel or parallel universe stories, is that you can change and you can right some wrongs that occurred in the real timeline. It's hopeful to be able to play with this idea that if you believe in quantum physics, which many people like to believe in, is that for every decision that we make, a new universe opens up and a different timeline begins where different choices occur. And so time travel stories have to sort of grapple with that. And, I'm getting off topic a little bit, but it's dealing with gender. And that's something that you brought up, dealing with what happened to women and gender. When I tweaked the timeline, I was able to offer up at least this great example of a woman succeeding as a writer in a time when women weren't. And so that was fun. In terms of race and religion, Shakespeare, when Shakespeare created Shylock, he was using a very old template of certain dramatic characters. So there were, there was the king and the queen and the fool, and one of them was, and I'm putting this in italics, there was the Jew. And so Shylock comes right out of that type. And to his credit, Shakespeare did round him out and give him more humanity than the type had. And ironically, of course, in this, he considered this to be a comedy, which it is not, except there are weddings at the end of The Merchant of Venice, which is the hallmark of noting that a Shakespeare play is a comedy. But Shylock ends up without his religion, his daughter, his money, or his vocation. And this is not funny.
Right,
So
right.
it was another thing I could change with the timeline. I could play around with that play.
When I thought about The Merchant of Venice, and it was probably in high school when I read it or was exposed to it, so I felt I had to re-engage with it from this perspective and from a perspective that I hadn't considered in a long time. And, that's something that I think readers will also enjoy about this book in a way that it could be a light read for those looking for a bit of fantasy and romance, because it has that. But it also really pulls us into the life in Elizabethan England, which is very stinky, very stinky. And, it has elements of Shakespeare's work, liberally in the book. So even if the reader is casually acquainted with Shakespeare, let alone more of a follower, there's a satisfying Shakespearean texture here. So I thought that was kind of fun. And I think maybe some people who aren't even clued into Shakespeare very much at all might not realize really how ubiquitous his writing is into our, I want to say, even vernacular. I mean, there are phrases that even now I say Shakespeare said that. That was in a Shakespeare play that we use so routinely. And so I think people will have fun no matter how they come into the book. They'll have fun with that element of it.
For those who love Shakespeare, there are a lot of in-jokes in the text that hopefully either are noticed or not noticed, but still work. I cannot write a sonnet. And I did have a friend of mine who is not only a Shakespearean expert, but also a poet. She wrote two sonnets that are in this book. And they appear, they're so, I don't want to give them away too much because they sort of answer some of the questions at the end of the book. But I thought that was just the best part, is that she was able for me to sort of catch his voice and use his, you know, his format, his sonnet format, and also work in some elements of the plot of the story, which was really fun.
I'm wondering what other kind of research into Elizabethan London and modern London, which at least that Jessica was familiar with. What kind of research did you have to do about that? Because you do draw a detailed and visceral picture of Elizabethan London.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, call me crazy, but I have imagined time travel, and I usually decide against it because I do want to bring all the stuff that I would want to have, like antibiotics. And so when Jessica appears and she looks and sees what is around her, I decided that I was going to go for what was probably really around her. And I, for one thing, I did a lot of research about food. You know, what did they actually eat, and why did they eat, and how did they eat? What cutlery was important, and why was mustard in everything? And, you know, thinking about unpasteurized milk and cheeses, and you know, it was really kind of daunting to get her there and think, oh my gosh, what is she going to wear? And so there are people who like to dress up like this. So this is, you know, a Renaissance fair. It's very handy. You can see all the clothing, and people are still creating all these outfits so for dress up and for reenactments. And so that was available to me. There were maps, and there were a number of, one book was The Time Traveler's Guide to Elizabethan England, which was super fantastic because then I could get there and feel like I knew, you know, where we were. And there was another book, Elizabeth's London. So just to see the lay of the land. And, you know, my mother and I traveled to London, and we went to the Globe. We walked around the areas where the plot happened and where Jessica, you know, has been in her timeline. So, you know, just a lot of on the ground walking around, and then a lot of reading about, you know, trying to get to these mysteries of Shakespeare, who he was and who he was writing to. Probably Stephen Greenblatt's book, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, was, you know, informative about him. And then at some point with research, you know, because I just have to sort of let it go, you know, read and read and read and look and look and look. And then I just have to write the story. But this was very research intensive. And I'm glad it reads a little bit light too, because, you know, research can just drown a story.
There is a lot of lightness and a lot of humor in the book. And so, and there's romance and her desire. And so that is always fun. And yeah, with the historical elements, I just thought it was a kind of a good mix of that and satisfying.
Good.
So we're talking with Jessica Barksdale Inclán, and the book is The Plays the Thing.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really fun. It's a privilege, really, to be able to talk about my work. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Just as Shakespeare has lots of fantasy in his own work, so too does The Plays the Thing. And I've been talking with the author of this literary fantasy, Jessica Barksdale Inclán. That's spelled Inclán. She also has a recently released volume of poems titled Grim Honey. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Santa Rosa author Nancy Economy well represents the immigrant experience in her novel The Classic Grill, a tale of Greek gods and immigrant heroes. Nancy has been a writer since she can remember, primarily in marketing, where she had a long tenure with the Jackson Family Wines, and has also written screenplays and was involved in production of the film The Russian River, All Rivers, The Value of an American Watershed. Economy's novel is partially based on her Greek family and a former restaurant in Santa Rosa, California, also called The Classic Grill. Let's listen to our conversation. Nancy Economy, welcome to talk about The Classic Grill, a tale of Greek gods and immigrant heroes.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The book opens with, "We are all immigrants. Immigrants make America great." This is a story of a Greek family in the restaurant business in the 1940s, Vallejo, California. And I hope I'm pronouncing their name right, the Papayannis family.
You've got it.
Immigrated to this country earlier in the century. And the narrator of the story, George, along with his brother, Demo, they are first-generation Americans. So that creates some of the tension right there, as well as this period of history. So tell us a little bit about what drove you to tell this particular story.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. And the inspiration for this book started out growing up in a Greek-American family. Like, as you said, my grandparents or that generation came over in the early 1900s, and my parents were first generation. I'm second generation. However, my grandparents didn't speak much English. And when they did, when they talked to us, my sister and I, they didn't know fairy tales. They didn't know, you know, traditional American things, and they didn't have toys for us. But what they did do was sit down with us and tell us about the Classic Grill. They told us about their restaurant. They told us recipes. They talked about their customers, how they made banquets, who was in the neighborhood, how they walked to the store, to the restaurant. And how many hours they work per day, how they got one day off in their entire life, one vacation they took one time. And so these stories sat with me and resonated with me even as a kid. I thought, well, these are some special times here. And so I kind of filed those stories away. So like I said, most Greeks have a restaurant in their background. And I realized that the Greek restaurant experience hadn't really been told much. We've seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which was hilarious, and we know Zorba the Greek, but in between, there weren't too many tales telling that story. So I decided that I would use the bits and pieces that I had heard from my grandfather about his restaurant in Vallejo, California, and his brother's restaurant, which was in Santa Rosa, California, right where the mall would be right now. You know, the hand sculpture that's out there, that's where it was put. And there Greek friends also had a restaurant in Napa, California. So there were three Classic Grills running from about the late 20s to about the mid 40s. And so I set my story in Vallejo, California, because what's more dramatic than being in a naval town during World War II.
Yes, yes. And so your family's restaurant was called the Classic Grill.
Yes, it was. Uh-huh.
And the story is told to us as a reminiscence. And George, one of the son, he is reminiscing to an audience, which is comprised of some people in a restaurant he's having some coffee at, and workers and customers of the restaurant. George, the old man, he's an old man. He's the narrator remembering his family and times past. But we also hear the voice of young George through much of the story. And young George really had a bit of wisdom, too. And we experience his thoughts during both parts of his life, really, as an old man and as that young boy or teenager. So what made you decide to use this sort of mechanism of this storytelling, and you thread all of this Greekness into the book? And I just thought of this group that he was telling stories to, almost mimicking a Greek chorus. So why did you choose this kind of structuring of somebody reminiscing and storytelling in the book?
That's a good question. I had the original story of the 1940s dramatic family story in mind, and I had that outlined, and I was beginning to write it, but somehow it felt like it might not resonate with current audiences. I wasn't quite sure if people would really gravitate toward a story in 1942, no matter how dramatic I made it. So I thought, well, how could I make it more relevant? And then I thought, well, you know, there's somebody who, you know, George, the youngest of the bunch, he could still be an old man, but look back on those times. But also, who's he telling the story to? He's telling the story to kids like him, who are kids of immigrants. They're working in the fast food restaurant. They're from many ethnicities, and they all sort of go through the same thing. They don't want to tell their father that their brother might be gay. The father is a strict authoritarian. They're working hard to, you know, play both worlds, the modern contemporary world and then the ethnic role they have to play at home. So I try to show that immigrants are valuable no matter what country they come from, no matter what generation, no matter what decade in time. There's always a new set of immigrants coming in, and they should be valued. They bring a lot to this country. And looking back on George's life, we see that they are valuable people. And I hope that reflected on the kids that George was talking to, all of their ethnicities and what they bring to the table.
Because there was, as the story progresses and the chapters that are in, I'm going to call it modern day, that there is a real connection that George reflects upon, actually, between his youth and these young people that he was talking to, that does kind of universalize the immigrant experience.
Yes, I try to do that. And also, I think there's that generation gap where here old George is, you know, pretty much pushing 90, and he thinks that no one's going to value his story of being a kid of an immigrant and how it all worked, and how he sort of survived and how the family carried on. But here he makes friends with these kids from all different backgrounds, and they kind of flock to him as if he's a grandfather, you know, telling them it's going to be okay.
As I mentioned, one of the brothers is Demo, short for Demosthenes, who was a Greek statesman who learned his rhetorical skills by studying speeches of previous great orators. And I am not up on my Greek history. I had to look that one up. But this is exactly what Demo does. Demo is the older of these two brothers, first generation American. And he is pursuing acting by reciting soliloquies from Greek theater. And you have a lot of humor in the book, but really there are some difficult relationships, and the setting in this time period during the war years is hard and challenging also. Yet it seems like you, as the author, have fun with elements of the story, of the Greekness of it, like the names. I mean, their very flawed father is named Achilles. So what kind of research did you have to do into Greek history and theater, and how much of this is just purely from your background?
Well, I would like to tell you I have great knowledge of ancient Greek history, literature, and the arts, but I had to do my research like most authors do. And so I think the name Achilles was pretty telling, since he has several big flaws. And I tried to name the characters sort of after what they what their name implied, like Chrysoula, which means sort of golden one or precious one. And she was precious in the book.
The mother.
Uh-huh. And yes, we know Demosthenes, the orator, and the youngest son, George, who doesn't love an honest George. You know, he's everybody's favorite, usually that kind of name. So that, I just took that sort of from the heart. But otherwise, all of the Greek dramatic bits that Demo spews out in front of on the stage and all that, I definitely had to research those to try to make sure they were on point with what he was trying to get across at the time. So I researched that. But then a lot of the other bits, Greek bits that you mentioned, are family things that, you know, most Greek families go through. Everybody loves to eat. It's all, you know, if someone walks in the door, like most ethnic families, are you hungry? If you haven't eaten four meals that day, you're going to eat a fifth. So Greek mothers always will do that. And, you know, the baking, it's always happening in the kitchen. And like, I think my big frat Greek wedding said, you know, the Greek man, of course, wants to be and thinks he's the head of the household, but the woman really is the neck that turns the head, that kind of thing. So always, you know, usually strong women are in Greek households. So I took a lot from, you know, my personal, you know, family structure, the extended family. And then of course, you know, the Greek community in which I lived. I grew up in Sacramento and many, many wonderful Greek people and Greek families there. So I definitely had a Greek American background from which to draw. There's no doubt about that.
Well, food is a big part of the book. Of course, it's a restaurant, and between George, the younger brother, wants to be in the restaurant business. And so he's always experimenting with food, and he has this phyllo wrapped chicken, and the mother, how did you pronounce her name? Chrysoula?
Chrysoula. It's kind of a rolling case on Chrysoula.
Well, her desserts, just reading about them, I just wanted to be reading the book with a piece of cake in front of me.
Actually, you can get the recipe for George's phyllo wrapped chicken on my website, nancyeconomy.com. So I'm going to continually add recipes to it that you find in the book. And chicken fricassee is coming up, but George's phyllo wrapped chicken is up there right now. So if anybody wants to kind of cook along with the classic grill, they can do that.
Well, that's good to know. Put some of those dessert recipes up there. It's fun to read a book where it just makes you want to eat. We'll let that for another conversation. But so these two brothers, they're the sons of Achilles, who's running the restaurant. And Demo is the older son, and he does not want to be in the restaurant business. He wants to pursue acting and the theater. And George is the one who really wants to be in the business, but this is something untenable to the father, who the oldest son is the one who's going to be carrying on. And Demo is gay in 1940s. You know, this is the 1940s, and he's a young man, and he's trying to break free, and this is a major source of tension. And so can you talk a little bit about that? It created a lot of turmoil within the family.
Well, that's exactly right. A big source of tension, of course, saying that you were gay. And I mean, I don't pretend to speak for the gay community, but from my research and from talking to people I knew at the time, you didn't really want to say that you were gay in 1942. But for Demo to be more transparent than most and especially to his father, his family, that was unthinkable. And the fact that their, you know, the father's vision for the future was to have his number one son go to UC Berkeley, be his businessman. They would, you know, make wonderful restaurants all across the nation, fancy ones, and no one would ever want for money. And that is Achilles' big thing. He, coming from poverty, it's on his back to make sure the next generation, every generation is secure. No one's ever going to be hungry again. And the fact that Demo not only doesn't want to do that, he also, he says he doesn't want to do it gently, but firmly. And also he does not hide the fact that he's gay, blows Achilles' circuits. He cannot deal with it. He doesn't know what to do. He has no idea. And in that fury and in that blindness of wanting Demo and only Demo, he completely ignores George, the person he really needed the whole time. So I thought that was a great tension. And also, you know, from talking to people in the 40s, like my my uncle Bill Economy, who lives in Los Angeles now, and he is in his early 90s with a memory like a steel trap, forgets nothing. He tells me details that I didn't even know I needed to put in the book. And he, you know, mentions at that time, no one, of course, said that they were gay, and those who might, it might leak out, were punished. They were worried about their safety and security and oftentimes their life. And it got pretty, pretty tough for people who, you know, as we mostly know now. Again, I'm not trying to speak for the gay community, but from my research, that's the way it was. So what more dramatic than that, to have big dreams on one side, but big dreams on the other. And Demo was courageous enough to want to pursue what he wanted, no matter what, one foot in front of the other, he was going to live his dream. And that's the source of the conflict.
And there's another character, a Japanese immigrant, Tetsuya, who has worked with their father, with Achilles, for many years. But he is almost like a second father to George. Because as you just said, George was the one who wanted to grow the business. And he had a lot of excitement about it. But he was the second son. And Tetsuya understood George because he faced something similar in his native Japan. And he's an understated but very important character in the book for a couple of different reasons. So can you talk a little bit about the character, the Japanese immigrant Tetsuya, who worked in the restaurant with them?
Since this is a book about immigrants, what bigger blight on our nation was to intern Japanese and Japanese Americans in 1942. And since it is a naval town, and I had to show that painful, dramatic, horrific process of ripping people from their homes and putting them in camps, and the fear and the agony and the loss it caused, financial loss and emotional loss it caused. So Tetsuya is definitely George's second father. He's understanding. He loves the boys. He loves George. But he also was a second son in Japan and got kicked out. So he made his way to America slowly but surely. And he and Achilles hooked up in their younger cooking days. And they kind of protected each other. And they were just sort of there for each other. Like many of my grandfather's, you know, cooking crew. They were from mostly Greek, but different places sometimes would be in there. And they would all just sort of unify and protect each other because they were kind of all they had. And they were sort of one step away from poverty. So Tetsuya is a really important part, I feel, because it just shows another strong immigrant group and what they had to endure. And then when they came back, what they had to endure. So I want to make sure to get that in there.
And that resonates really in our current moment. You know, we seem to be going through a very overt Asian backlash of some sort, you know, where there's a lot of hostility toward Asians, many of whom have been in this country for generations. So I guess I thought that there was something really resonant about that. And I think it's always, you know, you have a novel here, but it seems like it's an important thing to be able to talk about our history with people and immigrants, and understand what we have done, what we have come through to kind of better walk forward about that. So Tetsuya, I thought, was, and he had a very special relationship with George that was kind of confounding to George. And George is haunted in a way, even into his old age, about the fact that he felt he should have done something, that he should have spoken up. But that was kind of defining for him, that he didn't speak up.
Yes, well, he had two occasions. He loved people, and things happened to them, to those people, and he didn't do anything. Now, as a kid, a teenage kid, 16 years old, in 1942, what can you really do against the U.S. government? However, he felt he should have done something, said something, you know, but he didn't have the wherewithal. He didn't have the tools, as we call them today, to do anything about it. And then he didn't really stand up for Demo when he could have. You know, he doesn't go beat up the people who beat Demo up. But Demo said, don't worry about it. Just let it go. And he always felt he should have done more because he loved those people through and through. And I'm hoping that's sort of just a teaching moment for us all to, you know, speak up when we can for those people that we love and we value.
And as you say, it's not always easy for a youngster or a teenager to do that, but it is something that he thought about throughout his whole life. Also, Achilles, the dad, he embraced America. Though he was sending money back to Greece, he wanted his restaurant to be a good American restaurant. And he was serving lots of people there in Vallejo. He had Roosevelt's Four Freedoms pinned to the wall and just felt like an American. But at one point, some of the white political establishment in Vallejo, they come in to eat in the restaurant, but they demean and they try to intimidate him and push out the Greeks. But he really wasn't intimidated by them.
I based part, not all, of the character of Achilles on my grandfather, who loved this country, America. He used to say, in Greece, you work all day, you make nothing. You come to America, at least you make something. So he set his sights on making something. And like I said, he took my grandmother on, you know, like one day vacation to Tahoe. That was it, his whole life. He worked every single day and he was happy to do it because on his back, my dad and my uncle Bill were able to, you know, go to college and that sort of thing. So that, not desperation, but absolute locked in goal, will make money at no matter what I have to do, I will make money and support this family. So that is part of Achilles' background. And then the other part, that sort of the discrimination in town, I've got the story and it kind of follows closely in the book. Here in Santa Rosa, my great uncle's restaurant, the Classic Grill, across the street competition didn't like the foreigners because they were doing a pretty good business. So they put up a sign in their window. They said, don't eat at the Greeks. Don't eat across the street because they're not American. Well, that didn't do much for my great uncle, who actually was a citizen. And so similar, but not quite, but pretty close to the story. They put up their own window showing he was in World War I. And he put up his, you know, memorabilia, and he got veterans of foreign wars out to stand with them and take a picture that they were just as American as everybody else. So they had to go through their not so pleasantries around here in Santa Rosa because, you know, when there's competition, they'll try to make you look weak. But my relatives wouldn't stand for it. So So I tried to document that in the book because that one really is a true story. In fact, I have a picture that my relatives gave me when I was researching the book. And there they are standing in front of, you know, under their awning, under the Classic Grill awning with the veterans showing their pride in America.
So before I let you go, I also noticed you have a producer credit on the local documentary, which many of us saw in Santa Rosa when it screened there, The Russian River, All Rivers, The Value of an American Watershed from 2014. And I wonder if you could talk about your involvement in that film. If I recall, those were very hot tickets at the time, and I think some of our listeners may have been at one of the screenings. So tell us about that.
Well, actually, KRCB did air it twice in two one-hour segments, so that was really great of them to do that. Well, I was working with the co-producers, William Sorensen and Stella Kwiecinski, who had the idea of researching the health, the well-being, and really the value of the Russian River to our community here in Sonoma County. And the Russian River, of course, is sort of exemplary of other rivers going through the same problems in this time of, you know, drought and overuse and that sort of thing. So it took a while to produce because everyone was working other jobs at the time, but slowly and surely, it was actually a wonderful thing to take part in. I helped on productions and help on the publicity and that sort of thing. I loved getting out there in the water, on the water, underneath the river, you know, anywhere you could possibly go, places I'd never really thought about that were so beautiful. And this was right at the end of the drought in 2014. The first screening occurred, and it was important because there is fact based. The producers, William Sorensen and Stella Kwiecinski, financed it, so it wasn't financed by any corporate entity. And truly, it was one of the best things I've been involved in because it was beautiful, but it was also factual. And it laid it all out there for everyone to, all in one place, the history, and then looking forward and what other people were doing that was good for the river. And if we don't take care of it, what will happen? And here we are back in another drought. And so it'd be really nice for the supervisors to see that film one more time, because I think it brings a lot of truths to the fore.
Very good. Nancy Economy, the book is The Classic Grill, A Tale of Greek Gods and Immigrant Heroes. I appreciated talking to you, Nancy. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
My conversation with Santa Rosa author Nancy Economy, and her book is The Classic Grill, A Tale of Greek Gods and Immigrant Heroes. Earlier, we heard from Jessica Barksdale Inclon with her literary fantasy, The Play's the Thing. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you a novel idea the first and fifth Sunday of the month. You can listen to podcasts of this and past shows at krcb.org, follow the radio program and podcast links, or download the KRCB app on your mobile device and listen that way. I thank James Morey and Mark Prell for production support. We are a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media. I thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.